in my clinical work. No matter it's treating insomnia or anxiety, I notice one method works really well for many people. That is breathing technique, especially belly breathing. As adults, we are used to engaging in breathing through our chest. But if you look at babies, babies actually breathe through their belly. And there are research showing if we practice more belly breathing, that really can help us regulate our nerve system and help us calm down our sympathetic nerve system and boost up and activate the parasympathetic nerve system. That can help us not only relax our body, but also feel more calm mentally. Dr. Cohen from episode 195 actually shared more research and neurological pathways about this. If you're interested, please feel free to review that episode. So we know practicing breathing can possibly help us sleep better and feel less anxious. But then, after today's conversation with Dr. Fleshman, I learned something new. I learned that breathing can also help women's sexual health. For example, to help women to cope with urinary incontinence. I never thought there's a relationship between breathing and women's sexual health. So first, let me introduce Dr. Fleshman. Dr. Nicole Fleshman is a board-certified urogynecologist and urologist with over 20 years of clinical experience, specializing in female pelvic health. She is the visionary behind the groundbreaking Second Mouth framework, which challenges conventional approach to pelvic floor health and incontinence. Dr. Fleshman is a dynamic thought leader and advocate for holistic, evidence-based treatment. She also recently launched her book called The Second Mouth, One Woman's Journey to Decoding a Hidden Language for a New Era in Women's Health. In this book, she explores the often overlooked connections between breathing, posture, and pelvic health. In addition to her innovative work, Dr. Fleshman continues to practice as a busy urologic surgeon in a hospital-based system. She taught for many years at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and trained dozens of fellows in urogynecology how to be skillful and thoughtful surgeons. If you are as curious as me, let's dive in the conversation together. Hello, Dr. Fleshman. Welcome to Deep Into Sleep podcast.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
I'm very excited to have you. I know you work a lot with empowering women, and you have a book called The Second Mouth. And before we get started to dive into more topics, just want to understand what got you into this field, what makes you interested in these topics?
So my field is called urogynecology, and it's gone through many different names since I've been part of this field. But right now, that's the standing name, urogynecology. And we are medical doctors, so we're trained in, you know, allopathic medical school for the most part. Some of us are osteopaths, but we are physicians, and we go through a residency in either gynecology or urology, and then we do advanced training called a fellowship on female pelvic medicine. And we are surgeons for the most part. So we do a lot of surgery, mostly to correct things like leakage, bladder incontinence, and, you know, falling bladders, organs dropping out, a lot of the childbirth related injuries that we see. And we treat problems that affect so many women on the planet. And there's really just not enough of us to go around. And I got interested in the field because I've always been very passionate about women's health. And it was something that I always cared deeply about. I don't really know why, I just did. And maybe because I had, you know, a mother who had some health issues, but I always gravitated to that area and I have never left.
Wonderful. I think it's very much needed area. And myself, I work in both sleep field and the sex therapy field. I notice a lot of women struggling with different like challenges, and pelvic floor challenges is very common. Sometimes there's pain, there's like muscle issues. A lot of women in my clinic, they don't know what our resources out there available.
Yes. And if they're in your clinic, just know they're everywhere. You know, 50% of women on the planet suffer from pelvic floor issues. Mm-hmm. And this number increases as you age. So by the time you're old, you are very likely to suffer from a serious pelvic floor problem. And that may be either urinary incontinence or recurrent urinary tract infections. These are all pelvic floor issues that are going to be more advanced as you get older.
Okay. So how do people understand, is this something I need to go to see a doctor? If so, what kind of doctor, what kind of specialist I should go to?
So I don't think that everybody needs to see a specialist, but I do think everyone needs to have a little bit of education about what their pelvic floor is, how it works, you know, how it develops. And these things can be taught without seeing anybody. They're just basic education, like anything else that we educate people on their bodies about. It's just that the pelvic floor has not been well understood historically. It's a scientifically very difficult area to study. And it also is a very taboo area that people do not like to discuss and talk about. Mm-hmm. And also, classically speaking, pelvic health or female pelvic health has been run by people who really don't have female parts, so to speak. And so, you know, a lot of the intuitive nature of the pelvic floor has been somewhat lost, I think. But that's not to say anything. I'm certainly grateful for all the people that have put their time and effort in this field. It's just, I think that we need a woman's touch here. And, yeah. And we are getting more women to come into the field, but it's still a very slow process.
Yeah. Definitely. I heard there's some data showing for women's like sexual pain, for example, it normally takes them more than 7 or 8 years on average to get even diagnosed before Yes. even getting treatment.
There was a new study that just came out in JAMA, and it was discussing how women are really leaving healthcare to go towards more wellness type, you know, specialists because they're not getting the care, the compassion, the, you know, it's a lot of gaslighting that goes on because many of these problems happen to women after menopause, some of them after childbirth. That's when your pelvic floor starts screaming at you. Usually at these milestone moments, like you've had a child or you've gone through hormonal changes, that's when you really get to know what your pelvic floor is. And how maybe possibly messed up it is, because it is messed up for a lot of us, and it shouldn't be that way. It's an education problem, and that's what I'm trying to do is to get education out. So thank you for having me, so we can educate everybody on their pelvic floors, how they work, what they do, and so forth.
Yeah, very much appreciate what you do. Sounds like there are lots of things we can do about it. There are resources or methods to help us get the pelvic floor healthier.
Absolutely. But the problem is not all these methods are good. So I think that there's a lot of misinformation that's very widely available to the public, and it's very hard for women to tease out what they should be listening to. There's also a huge culture that we're coming from, and it started probably 2,000 years ago, where women were taught to do things posturally that maybe not so good for them. And that's a conditioned behavior that's really like in our neural networks. And I, you know, it promotes a pelvic floor that's in spasm instead of a pelvic floor that's coordinated. So what I'm talking about is just even how we posture ourselves as women, and we're taught to suck in our stomachs. These are habits that we develop from an early age that are completely dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And yet no one tells us not to do them.
Wow. Let's go over some common misperceptions first. I think those possibly are
really
important.
We're going to get a few. We have a lot. We have a lot. And these misperceptions are really like, they're real turnarounds. I mean, you have to understand that some of the stuff I'm going to talk about are true 180 degree directions different from what we've learned. In order to have pelvic floor health, you have to kind of go in the other direction.
Yes. Okay. So what are the most common ones you notice people been carrying for all these years? And then through the education, they realize, oh, I totally look at this wrong.
So it really, you have to understand the framework of how we even learn to gain continence, meaning how we learn to, you know, not need diapers anymore. It starts at a really early age. And when we're two or three, and in other countries, I know you have a lot of Chinese people that listen to your podcast. I mean, I don't know in China what the standard age for toilet training children is. And here in America, it's about 2 to 3 years old, but some countries start a lot earlier. But regardless of when you train your children, the only thing that little kids can understand is how to hold. Holding behaviors start first in children because they're on a nervous system pathway that's much earlier to develop. That cortical spinal pathway is an early child development pathway, and it allows us to hold and clench and guard, and it helps us hold in our pee so that we can, you know, learn to make it a few hours between the, you know, toilet visits, and that's how we get out of diapers. But it turns out there's another part of toilet training that's a little bit more complicated. And at two or three, we're really not able to understand how to enact it. And that's the release part. That's what we do on the toilet to get urine out of our bodies. Our neural pathways are not developed enough at three to understand this properly. So we do something that we call pushing. We can call pushing what it is, or just bearing down. But that's a incorrect way to release something from your body. But the thing is, it works. It works very well. So as a child, when you learn something that works well, you don't need to change.
Yeah.
And then those neural pathways mature and you become a middle schooler and you're perfectly capable of learning something else, but you've been pushing your whole life and no one told you to stop. So you'll continue to do it beyond that time. And pushing to pee is really bad for you. It's not the way we're supposed to release urine from our bodies. It causes pelvic floor trauma. It damages our sphincter muscles, both anal and urinary, and it creates a weakness in our bottom that we don't need to have. Okay? Mm-hmm. So by learning that there's other ways to release things from our bodies without pushing, as we get older, we preserve our pelvic floor. And we also preserve our neural networks because the pelvic floor needs to learn release to develop healthfully.
Okay. Wow. So hold, push, all those we've been learning and practicing since we were young may not be that helpful.
I think they're a developmental stage. That's what they are. Perfectly appropriate for children. The problem is there needs to be another stage, another training session that happens when we're a little older. And that's when we can learn what release actually means. Because for most women, they're not aware they are pushing. This is why it's such an insidious problem. See, pushing is not something that most people know they do. But if you're holding your breath to start your stream, if you're just bearing down slightly, even if it doesn't feel forceful, it works, but it's called dysfunctional urinating, meaning you're not actually engaging your central nervous system to release. You're using a peripheral pathway, which works until it doesn't. It doesn't work as you get older. And that's why a lot of people, when they're aged, can't pee. They're in retention. They have terrible destroyed bladders, destroyed sphincters, and it was all how they peed their whole life because nobody told them how to release.
Wow.
Sad. This is my world. This is how I see the world. And listen, you're not going to hear this from everybody else, but if you understand that this is what I think and that I've been in practice for 25 years and I am a surgeon and I've been taking care of women the entire time, thousands and thousands of women. And this is my understanding. I'm a voracious reader of neurology. I'm a nerd. This is what's going on. And nobody's talking about it like this. And I see it that way. So I'm trying to get this understanding out because I think we can do better.
Totally agree. I think the biggest enemy is not knowing. Not knowing our own pattern, our own behavior, our own thoughts, what we are doing, right?
So the process is called interoception, that inner knowing process. Interoception is how you understand your inner body states, how your inner muscles are moving. So we have inner muscles and outer muscles. The pelvic floor is one of those inner muscles, and so is the diaphragm. And these two muscles don't make it on our brain map very well. They kind of need to be put there consciously, because if you don't put them on the brain map, we don't use them for their purpose. And that's when dysfunction really sets in. So most people do not know how to actually breathe with their diaphragm. They're doing something else. And it's a fascinating concept when you actually ask people to show you how they breathe. They don't know how to do it. And if you don't know how to do that, you don't know how to release urine from your body because they're connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I understand correctly, we possibly grew up trying to tense up our nervous system, our own body, when we actually should release. But we should learn as we grow up, we should learn how to relax our nervous system and body more. And that's
exactly
better pathway.
So the second stage of toilet training, which is what I talk about, has two main principles. Number one, I am not responsible for emptying my bladder. My bladder does it for me. I just need to open my bottom. Number two is I am not responsible for holding urine. My bladder does it for me as long as I give it some air. And those two principles are the second stage of toilet training, but we don't get to that point. It's a neuromuscular problem that we don't trust our bodies to hold and release for us. So we help it too much. We do what I call helping behaviors, but helping behaviors are not functional behaviors. Your body's designed perfectly and you're just getting in the way.
Okay. So what do you think about people nowadays when they are using restrooms, they're on their phone, they're not pay attention, they're not focused. Is there a way to help them actually relax their body, help with the second stage of toilet training, or is actually more harmful?
No, I can't tell you how many people I help with this knowledge. I re-toilet train people all day. The beautiful part of toilet training, especially the second stage, is you're never too old to get the lesson. Mm-hmm. I re-toilet train people in their 80s. I will tell you that it's easier to learn this stuff when you're younger than when you're older, because it does, you're trying to break a habit. Okay, this is a habit. Pushing and holding behaviors are habitual problems. They were conditioned into us as we grew. I would say that they were natural behaviors at one point, but they weren't conditioned out of us. Let's say that. You need to be conditioned out of these behaviors, either by mirroring. So mirroring really helps. Like if you're watching your mother, your sister, your friend do proper release behaviors, both when breathing or you're just aware of it, you'll pick those up just by mirroring, but you're not getting that feedback from your environment. Everybody else is clenching too. So I call this Plato's cave, where we're all in the dark modeling each other's bad behaviors and not learning. And our mothers are not teaching us because they don't know either. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to break a human cycle here where we understand that clenching is not how we're supposed to hold our pee in. We're not. So when you feel like you have to go to the bathroom, that instinct to clench tighter, we need to not do that. Mm-hmm. We need to breathe. And breathing needs to be done properly, not with our mouth open and not with our chest moving. Breathing is a lower half activity. Only the lower half needs to move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds like really listen to our body, similar to when I learned about sleep technique, how to help people sleep better. It's the same way. Go with the natural flow. Learn to listen to your body's signal and let it happen. Yeah,
you must, because if you do anything against what I call human design. I'm sure, I don't know if there's other words for it. I make up my own language to describe how I think about things. But human design means your body is designed to work a certain way. And maybe you never got a manual, but I think there is one. And that manual means that if you are not conducting yourself a certain way, you're going to have problems, especially as you age. And that manual means listening to your body. You cannot go against what your body is calling you to do. If you ignore your bladder, if you ignore your colon, if you suppress your urges, I am telling you, it's going to come out in other ways. So you have to say, what does my bladder want? And let me give my bladder what it wants. But you have to talk to it. You have to have the conversation. What does my bladder want? If you're just clamping all day to suppress the urge so that you don't have to go to the bathroom, and then you go to the bathroom and hover over the toilet and power pee, you're destroying your bottom and your neurology. And it's on so many levels because listen, here's the thing, and you probably see this in sleep or other areas if you're doing sexual medicine. When you're trying to do a parasympathetic-based activity, you have to have a parasympathetic system. You cannot bring a sympathetic system to do a parasympathetic activity, or it's an autonomic dysregulation automatically. So if you're clenching your bottom and you're trying to release urine, which is a parasympathetic thing, you're giving your body mixed signals. And that is not something that your brain knows what to do with, or your body. So you have to all decide together, your top and your bottom, what you're trying to do. Your bottom can't be saying hold while your top says release. They have to coordinate. They have to speak. There needs to be a communication system between your bottom and your top. You can call that your brain-body connection. You can call that pelvic floor awareness. There's lots of different ways to describe the mind-body connection. I don't really care what you call it. I'm talking about a coordination where your brain and your body are doing the same thing. They're on the same page. If you're clenching and releasing at the same time, that's dysfunctional, and everybody's doing that when they push.
Yes. Then I have another question. I think when we try to strengthen our pelvic floor muscle, we do the exercise to hold tight and then release. Then if we habitually hold our pee and then go to the restroom, is that helpful to strengthen the pelvic floor muscle actually, or it should be totally two different things?
So you're asking the right questions. And this is what paradigm shifts do. Okay. So we're talking about a shift in a paradigm, a shift in how we think about things. We're adding a new level that we need to consider. And when you add that new level, you have to go back and say, but what are we doing? And does that make sense? And that's exactly what you're doing right now. You're saying, but this, if what you're saying is true, Dr. Fleischman, then it seems to me like all the conditioning we're doing with Kegeling and pelvic floor strengthening, well, maybe that's not good for us, right? Isn't that the thing that comes through your mind? And I'm going to tell you, well, you're smart, of course, because you're thinking now. And that's what thinking does. It asks us to explore these conditioned behaviors. So I call it Kegel culture. Kegel culture has been conditioned into us, and it's been here for a really long time. And it's not how the body works, it's how children work. So it's advancing childhood dysfunctional behaviors to be squeezing your pelvic floor. Yes, it is. It's advancing those behaviors, especially if you've never developed the awareness to take your pelvic floor down. You said you're taught to, tighten and release, but release is not release at all. Release is a middle level. You need to really learn what release means. And I'm telling you, most people do not know what release actually is because release is only coordinated with breath. You cannot release your pelvic floor without your breath. Your breath is what takes the pelvic floor to an open state. So if you are just clamping and releasing while holding your breath, I am telling you, you are not doing yourself any favors.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes, and that's and it's a, and it's a neurological milestone to be able to release your pelvic floor with your breath. You have to be taught how to do it. So when you think about all these women that are going out there following these TikTokers, squeeze pelvic floor, squeeze
Oh.
pelvic floor, I'm telling you, all these ladies are ending up in my office in distress. And maybe it works for a little while because yes, you can hold your pee more, but you're only advancing your holding behaviors and you've done nothing to help your release, which is the actual problem.
Right. Wow. So it sounds like in combination of breathing work and to really learn how to train the body in a different way.
So there's a pathway that everybody has inside their body. I call it the sniff. The sniff. SNIFF. You all think about what a SNF is, but a SNF turns out to be the basic dormant pathway that we all need to learn in the second stage of toilet training. So it goes like this. If you just look at my face, I'm going to show you what a SNF is because believe it or not everybody can do it. So you have your mouth closed and you just pull air quickly through your nose like this. Watch me do it. Can you do that? Just your nose and release your abdomen. Yes. Did you feel it go through your body? Okay. Take a sniff and put your attention on your bottom. Do that again. Sniff. Yes, that's how you pee with airflow. You have to push with air. And by the way, that's also how you engage your diaphragm. The diaphragm only engages with nasal resistance. The sniff is what engages the diaphragm. Without diaphragm engagement with a sniff, you're not actually breathing with your diaphragm. So the sniff is the pathway to the bottom, and it's the one that you should use on the toilet. You pull the air so your bottom opens, and that's how you know you have a second mouth. It opens with airflow. And I tell people to do this. Just put your finger under your nose like this and just smell. Yes, you feel it go through you? Smell. And you have to do it. That's how you breathe. That's a lower half breath. And you should feel your breath hit your bottom. When you feel your breath hit your pelvic floor, you don't want to snap back against it. So a lot of people, when they do that sniff, their guarding reflex snaps at them if you start to pay close attention. And your goal is to suppress the clamp so you can get urine out with flow. You're trying to overcome your infantile guarding reflex, not sustain it. Does this make sense to you?
Yeah, how interesting. From the nose, air goes in. You actually really let go of the guard down there.
It's the only way to do it. The sniff is the only thing that kills the guard. And you have to kill the guard on the toilet because if he's on the toilet with you, you're obstructing your own flow. So the way this works from a neurological standpoint, and you don't really have to understand the science to just understand what I'm saying, your sniff contracts your diaphragm, which opens your pelvic floor. It's a neurologic connection, and you have to be able to learn that one to release without damaging yourself. And this is also for delivering a child too. You want to use your breath to release the child. That breath is a reset of your nervous system. Your sniff resets your nervous system if it kills your guarding reflex. It has to go and kill it. So it's a two-part process where you're stimulating your brain with the sniff and you're killing your guard below. So your brain attention has to go into two places at once, top and bottom, and then you build that brain connection. Maybe in the middle school years, we could get that. But is this the first time you've ever heard of this?
In this topic, yes. But actually, I went to a sleep doctor's lecture in Stanford a long time ago. They are talking about similar things, how to relax your body, how to help you to sleep better. A similar sniff, but it's a sniff release process.
Okay. Yes. So they understand the sniff. Do you know the sniff is one of the most underdocumented sensory modalities in humans? We don't even know its purpose. And it turns out to be the central axis of our body. And we need to understand these mechanisms. It just needs to be known that this is how our body should be because our sniff is how we develop interoception. When you sniff and you feel your body get it, yes, you're feeling the inside of your body. You're lighting up your body, which is just a dark space. Your brain is getting that feedback from your sniff. It's a system that's dormant in every human. And if you don't enact it throughout your life, you're going to see dysfunction.
Wow. Does that mean when I use restroom in the future, I should try to pay attention and sniff and start use this way
Yes,
to
you have
train
to.
myself?
You have to slow it down. It's also about posture. So breath and posture are what control the pelvic floor. Those two things together. And that's also the mind-body connection, I think, is based on breath and posture, not words. You can't speak to your body with words. Words is a arbitrary about much about sounds, right? Your body and your mind and your they don't speak in words. They speak in breath and posture. So when you're trying to tell your bladder, don't pee, I'm in a supermarket. You need to communicate with breath. You need to put breath down there, and that will release your urge so that you can make it to the toilet. You don't clamp around your bladder, which is suppression, and that's what children do. So you're learning a different way to operate your car. You're reading a more advanced manual, you're upgrading your software and understanding that you don't need these childhood behaviors. In fact, at some point, those behaviors are going to put you into diapers. You have to get rid of them. This makes sense? It's a big topic. You got me on with this very large topic, but I'm going to slow down and I'm going to let you ask some questions because I think, there are questions. I hope you have some.
Yes, just clarify this sniffing technique. It sounds
Okay.
like even when we in a situation we have to hold or we just cannot get to the restroom. Using sniff still a good way to communicate with our body. So it's not very goal-oriented or sniffing used when you go to restroom. It can be used in other chance.
So it's funny, but I really think we're supposed to be breathing like this all day long. And I always laugh when people ask, because you have to understand, I've been on this mission for several years. And everybody goes down the same path because first they think I'm just talking about what you do on the toilet, which to sniff to get your pee and poop out. But I'm actually talking about how you breathe and how your body would prefer to receive air. Because your body would prefer to receive air through your diaphragms and activation, not with your mouth open and your chest expanding. And if you are going to continue to breathe like that instead of breathe to your bottom with a sniff 10 times a minute, which is what you should be doing, it's h very hard, right? I mean, who can? It's a conscious breath. You actually have to think about your breath all day long. And who has the ability? You have to be a monk on a mountain to breathe consciously all day long. But it does become second nature. And by the way, you don't have to be perfect at it. You just have to do it once in a while. So what I tell people is, you're on a const. You're micromanaging your body, just like you micro. Most of us micromanage our lives. I work with a lot of women who are professionals and they've got kids and they're trying to figure it all out. And I said, you know how you micromanage everybody in your life? Just micromanage your breath a little bit. Just put your attention there, okay? And what you'll end up doing is taking the correct breath. You'll be orchestrating it now and then, and your bladder is going to get some blood flow because after menopause, when you lose estrogen, it's a no blood flow state down there. And if you are clamping and clenching like you did when you were younger, you're going to start to feel the burn. And all you need to do is to sniff to take it down, but you have to not guard against it. And releasing your guard is hard. You have to know it's there. It's really it's a process where you have to sort of accept that you have a clamp on the other side that you've got to get rid of. And the sniff will bring it out.
Now I'm wondering this sniff breathing, how different is from diaphragmic breathing? Because in
It is
psychology,
diaphragm breathing.
so
It
it's the
is
same.
diaphragm breathing. I think what we're talking about is a gap in embodied intelligence, because I see this all the time. So I have a respiratory therapist come see me, and I say to her, "Do you teach the patients how to breathe?" And she said, "Yes, I teach them to breathe with their diaphragm." And I say, "Show me how you do it." And she does something that's anything but a diaphragm breath because her chest is going like that. And I say, "You know, that's a nasal breath, but it's not a diaphragm breath. The diaphragm is below your rib cage. And you feel it go out when you relax your abdomen." And so many women are sucking in so tightly all day long, committing the capital crime of core compression, I call it. It's capital crime. Liver compression, pancreas compression. I think one day we're all going to go to jail for it. Because as we commit the crime of organ compression and diaphragm compression, we are not oxygenating our bodies well. And it's just that we just have to reframe how we think about our forms. We just have to get rid of the idea that we need to have a flat belly. It's not true. It's not true. It's just not how we're designed.
Now I understand because in psychology, we teach a lot of clients to really try a different way of breathing. And we make sure the chest does not move, the belly is moving. And that helps with people with ease their anxiety. But sounds like it really should be a habit for all like different things happening
Yes.
in our body.
It shouldn't be a rescue mission. It should be what you do all day long, but it is nervous system regulation. So when you sniff, what you're doing physiologically is you're taking the nitric oxide that's being generated in your paranasal sinuses and you're pumping it through your body. But you have to use nasal resistance to get the NO. So that's what brings the NO. Okay. And if it hits your pelvic floor, you're getting GABA. So this is like Valium, truly. And so what you want to be doing is pumping nitric oxide and Valium throughout your body while the world around you is crazy. And that's called regulating your nervous system. And it really works. So it shouldn't be something that you should wait for a panic attack to institute, because honestly, you're going to be too panicked to be able to engage that system. That system should be so second nature to you all day long that it even happens in your sleep.
Make it a habit. Really get used
to it. A habit during the day will start to hit the night. And then you really fix the problem. Because OSA, in my opinion, is a silly diagnosis because it's obstructed mouth breathing. You're not supposed to be mouth breathing. You're supposed to be nose breathing. So it's really just, let's convert what we think about even what OSA means. You're not supposed to breathe through your mouth. It's not the airway. We've just allowed it to be that.
Yeah. So much connection. And in sleep, we always try to encourage people. I even make a video before to encourage people to consider how to use nose breathing when we sleep. And I think this is totally can be learned. For example,
do you recommend mouth tape? Do you recommend taping? People always ask me that. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm afraid of taping my mouth. What do you think? Is that your?
Yeah, I talked to some doctors about that. I think we have to be careful. If you have very severe OSA, you may not want to tape your mouth because it does not solve the core problem. You still need the treatment, right? But when we tape our mouth, actually a lot of doctors suggest you do just a central tape vertically. You don't tape your whole mouth. Yeah.
So you can breathe out the corners if you have to.
Yeah, it's still safer that way.
But I think so. Nobody wants to suffocate.
Right, definitely. But that's not a solution, I think, for everyone. It won't solve all the problem. Just like I think in any medicine field, no one method can solve all the problem.
No, and I don't say that either. But what I say is you need fundamentals. You need a foundation to work with, and then you add the treatments on top of that. So that's how I still do a ton of surgery. I also give out medications, but I give them out very carefully. And I say, look, this is what you did. This is the lesson you didn't get. I'm giving it to you now, and I want you to practice it. And yes, I will help you with an overactive bladder medicine, or if that's not working, and I'll also train you many times. I'll give you pelvic floor therapy to help train you. And if that's not working, then we go to something else. And if your bladder's hanging out of you, yes, we're going to fix it. We're going to put it back inside, but I don't want you pushing it out again. So I need to train you to make sure you understand that pushing behaviors are what dropped your bladder out in the first place. I think it's unfair not to tell women that. And doctors do not say to women, you know, you have prolapse because you pushed your bladder out. Nobody says that. We say, oh, it's gravity and childbirth. But we don't give women the empowerment to say, you did this and you didn't have to, but you didn't do it on purpose. You did it because you didn't know.
Right.
And nobody educated you about this, which is sad. But I'm educating you about it now because I don't want you back on my table in 2 years. So I feel it's my responsibility to tell you.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's important. That's the empowering piece, to help women understand you learn this in a way, you can unlearn it and relearn it in a different way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not everybody likes, listen, I have to tell you, not everybody likes that that message. And I think that there are people that really just want to be fixed. But I think that's an infantile way of looking at your life, because nobody can fix you. You always have to fix yourself first.
Oh, so
and
true.
I think in medicine, we have sort of taken on that responsibility with our patients to say, don't worry, let me fix you. And we fail every time because we're not considering what they're doing or their experience or their environment that we have no control over. Yep. So I just don't believe it's a good way to practice medicine.
Yes, just like sleep medicines, a lot of patients come in, just want a pill. Give me a medicine, put me to sleep. I want to fix my problem, easy and quick. It's not like that. You have to do all the work yourself.
Yes. But when you do the work, here's the thing. See, when you do the work, it really does work. See, I'm not going to guarantee somebody that I'm going to be able to make them whole again. But I am telling them if they follow these steps, they will get very close, as long as it's not too far gone. As you know, there's people with advanced sleep problems that, you know, in a lot of ways you feel bad. You're like, I'm probably never going to be able to help this person. It's so advanced. And that's not that you don't try, but you sort of have this understanding that it's too far gone. Right. We don't want people to get to that point. We want to prevent people from getting there.
Yes. Then there's another question pop up in my mind. A lot of women, you know, their masturbation method is to squeeze their leg and to really squeeze to stimulate their clitoris. But that now, after listening to you, make me feel like that's a way of holding and tightening and make yourself more like tense up in your nerve system. What do you think about that method?
I think that female sexual health is a relatively untapped area, but we do understand the neurology is more complicated than in other parts of the body. For instance, having an orgasm or going through arousal involves both sides of the nervous system, sympathetic and parasympathetic. So the sympathetic system is what gets you aroused, but it's the parasympathetic that allows the orgasm to happen. So when you have these women who are just getting themselves so clenched up, they have to release at some point. They have to go past that point and release to have an orgasm. But I do think they're generating a lot of intra-abdominal pressure doing that. And I worry about the pressure in the brain. When you're squeezing so hard like that to stimulate the clitoris, I am telling you, you are literally, you measure your intracranial pressure when you do that. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't think that we should ever be raising our intracranial pressure. And you know what I'm talking about with that method. It's a way to just tense up and everything. And you're going to this level that's very high in terms of pressure. Mm-hmm. So I think there's other ways to do it, but I think it revolves you learning to release your muscles first. So hard. And I see this with women who have dyspareunia or painful sex. You know, a lot of them, they just can't, their husbands or their boyfriends, they can't get in because it's too painful for them. They can't release. They don't realize how tightly they're clamping. And it's a disconnection, I think. It's just they're disconnected from their bottoms. They don't see the clamping in themselves. Mm-hmm. They don't know it's happening until you point it out to them, and then they can take it down. So it's like a body disconnection. It's a disembodiment. Is that, I guess that's the way you would say it? It's a disembodied state that a lot of people are in, not knowing that their bottoms are clamped. They just don't know it. They're disconnected.
Okay. Yeah.
It's crazy, right? It's a very psychological process. It's and it affects all of us. I just think it's a very human condition where we're disconnected from our bottoms and we don't know these muscles are clamping without our awareness.
Right. Well, I like the good news that once we know, we can start thinking about, do I want to do something about it? Yeah.
Yes. And the way to know is to develop pelvic floor awareness, which is a simple process of learning how to breathe. But you have to learn to breathe with nasal resistance, engaging your diaphragm and not clamping against it so that you can get a true lower half breath. And that's how you find your pelvic floor and you notice it, whether it's clamped. It's like you see it for what it is, truthfully, in your brain. Mm-hmm. And that's a developmental milestone.
Right. I know we got into such a big topic, but I also want to make sure I understand all the other misperceptions. If there's anything we haven't touched on that you see a lot among women visiting your office, anything else you notice you find yourself have to teach them, educate them a lot repeatedly?
There's many myths, and I could try to list them. The one is that the pelvic floor, you're leaking urine because your pelvic floor is weak. That's not true. Most people who leak urine have an over-tense pelvic floor. What they're doing is they're tensing and pushing and damaging their sphincter muscle so that they leak urine, or they're just pushing their bodies out of shape. They're distorting the bottom so urine leaks out, but the muscles themselves over-tight. So that's one of the reasons I'm not a huge Kegel fan. Kegel is one of those myths I'd like to try to dispel. The other one is sucking in the stomach, core compression, that's healthy, that stabilizes the spine. It's not true. The truth is, we are straight spine, belly out creatures. We've always been that. Just like monkeys and all the other animals are straight spine, belly out. We can't be straight spine, flat bellied because that's organ compression. We can't be that. One of them has to give. We either have to curve our spine or let our bellies out. Otherwise, our organs have no space. So just these myths that hold us in, these are the things that we need to get rid of. What else? That you can nose breathe through your chest? You can't. You shouldn't be moving your chest at all when you breathe. If you move your chest at all, you're stimulating your sympathetic nervous system, and you should try to avoid it at all costs. Constant corrections. Oh God, I have so many. Don't walk around butt clenching. Listen, these are, I don't even know if they're called myths. They're just foundational things that we need to learn before we go to the doctor that affect everybody.
But other than you, rarely we hear this from anyone, right? That really remind me when I entered the sleep medicine field, the first thing I noticed is so many knowledge just totally different, the opposite than what I think I knew before. And that shocks me. And I feel like in your world, it's similarly. The more you know, the more you realize it's different.
Yes, and that's what happened to me. But I will tell you, I don't hear a lot of people talking the way I do. So I am on your podcast and I'm trying to get a voice out that's a little bit different because I see these dysfunctions very clearly and I don't think that they are very well visualized in general. I don't think we know that we have an unconscious guarding reflex that's holding us in all the time, and we need to learn to release it onto it. This is not maybe the pediatric urologists are understanding this on a level, but they hand them off to us, and then we deal with the adult dysfunction. So I'm just constantly trying to educate because I feel like what I learned is not what I talk about now. I had to take a lot of the things that I learned and trash them. I did. I thought the pelvic floor was weak too. I thought that for a really long time, and I prescribed Kegels to everybody. And now I have a lot of guilt about that because I had to have a real enlightening experience where I realized everything I thought was wrong, everything I was taught was wrong, or just upside down.
Yeah, that
Yeah,
makes
a
me
little bit.
curious. What in the process of your practice make you realize, wow, that actually does not work. This is something different.
It started a few years ago, but I was trying to treat women for stress incontinence. That's leakage when you cough and sneeze with something we called a bulking agent. Bulking agents are like fillers, like you fill the lip with, but we fill the urethra with it to tighten it up so that when you cough and sneeze, you don't lose urine. But I was injecting it in a slightly different way than I was taught to do it. We're always taught to put these injections close to the neck of the bladder, right at the opening of the bladder. But I didn't think it worked very well there. So I moved back to an area that was closer to the sphincter muscle, and I started injecting there, which is not something I was taught to do. And I sort of did it unconsciously. It just looked like it was a better place to go. It was closing up tightly and nicely. And then I noticed that people were getting drier with these injections, but a week or two later, they weren't dry anymore. And through asking questions, it became very apparent to me that all these women were pushing out the gel. They were just pushing it out after I put it in because they didn't know how to open their sphincter muscles. So I was like, what's going on? How come everybody's pushing? I knew that pushing behaviors were common, but we weren't picking them very well on our testing. Urodynamic testing, which is how we measure the bladder and how it functions, it doesn't pick up women's patterns very well. It picks up the male patterns much more easily. It's just, urodynamics has always been a little bit hard to do in women. So I really think we've been reading them wrong and not realizing that everybody's pushing to pee. And so this was like a major realization. I'm like, okay, if everybody's pushing to pee, and that's not neurologically how you're supposed to do it, what went wrong? How come everybody's pushing? It's not that they are pushing because it's easier or faster, that they just don't know another way. And then I started training on breath work and how to open the bottom because I knew there was a way to do it, even though we weren't teaching people that. And when I started teaching women how to open their bottoms, all of a sudden their incontinence was going away. Wow. just like that. So it's a really powerful method, and it's very under researched.
Yeah.
And maybe it won't be any further researched if it stops with me, but I'm going to keep talking about it while I'm alive, just in case people start listening and start sniffing out their pee. It'd be great. Make me so happy.
Right. Wow. So it sounds like some surgeries can totally be avoided.
My surgical volume's gone down a lot since I started toilet training women. When I started teaching people how to pee and poop, I noticed my volume went down by 50%, which is a lot for a surgeon and not great for my bottom line. But I'm okay with it now because I feel like I'm really helping people now in a way that I never did before. And my outcomes are so much better because my patients don't go into urinary retention after we do surgery. They know how to pee after. Nobody's going home with a catheter. People aren't getting constipated. I'm training them first.
Yeah.
And it makes all the difference. And I think we should all be doing that. But it's like nobody thinks about women this way. We think about them as objects that we're going to nail closed and we'll fix you. And then when you come back in 3 years with your bladder out again, well, I'll fix it for you again.
Wow. It's just train the woman to learn how to breathe in a different way and be aware of their body and muscle tension. You find that's already helpful, or you have a whole series of methods you normally teach
That's,
people?
That is the method. The method is breath. But you have to develop with postural awareness. So when I do my breath teachings, which I spend a lot of time with my patients with, you're doing it in different postures. So you're learning it lying down, sitting, toileting, and also standing up. Because taking that breath has a different feel in your body depending on the posture you're in. And you have to sort of train your brain to know that pathway in all these different postures. And once you do that, that's true nervous system regulation. Anytime you want.
Yeah. Wow. This is very empowering that we can do something and train our own body to totally function different way. Now, I have another question. When I went to sexual medicine conferences, I always noticed there's some equipment there, right, from certain companies. Some equipment, they talk about what they can just do something with the pelvic, like a private area, and to help women. They said it's tighten up their muscle, but now I think, I'm not sure whether they are actually helping women to release some of that muscle tension using some kind of machine down there.
Okay, so let me address that. All right, there's two machines I'm going to talk about.
Okay,
if we have time. One is laser therapy, and I don't know if you're talking about that, but laser therapy or CO2 fractionated laser, radio frequency laser. These are all energy treatments that we do in the vagina to help stimulate collagen growth and lubrication, and these sort of replace or assist estrogen replacement. So anything that you can do to, you know, make the vaginal tissues healthier, more lubricated, more blood flow, that's all good for pelvic health. So laser treatments do work, but they're always cash. Those are not available to everybody, which is sad. And they never will be because they're always considered cosmetic, even though they help actually with urinary tract infections, but they'll never cover them for that. So that's women's health, right? The other thing I wanted to talk about is something like I think you're describing, which would be either a device or something like the Emsella chair. So the Emsella chair is basically a chair that you sit on for 20 minutes, and it delivers like these electromagnetic waves through your pelvic floor. And the marketing slogan of that company is like 1,000 Kegels in 20 minutes. Now, I think they shoot themselves in the foot because I'm trying to kill the Kegel. So I'm going to go out there and say the Emsella chair sucks if Kegels are what they are doing, but it's not. Okay. Nobody can make you tighten. Only you can tighten. That's a nervous system activation, and there is no electromagnetic wave that can do that for you, but it can bring blood flow into the area. So when you stimulate the muscles with any kind of, like with a TENS machine or any kind of electromagnetic wave, you're basically causing the muscle to contract and release, but in a healthy way that brings blood flow to that area. And that often helps relief of some of the spasm below. So I think it's not at all the marketing slogan. It's actually probably doing something good. Again, not covered by insurance, not available to everyone, but still something that someone can explore if they want to. I have no problem with these treatments, but I still think you should start with your breath. I think that before we start going to devices and lasers, we can learn to connect to our pelvic floors just by sniffing towards it and noticing it's there and giving it a shot of blood flow with your sniff every time you do it, because that's a good thing to do. You just realize your pelvic floor is getting no air unless you provide it. None. Zero. A little bit. But just peripherally, it's not getting active flow, and you want to provide active flow to that area with your breath.
Yes. Wow. It's such an easy technique. I think if I understand correctly, I think our audience, whoever watching and listening, they possibly can start going home to try to practice sniffing and with different gestures, right? They can try this when they
Yes.
sit, when they stand up, when they lay down,
Right.
and just try it, see
But
how it is.
the sniff is not just a quick sniff. You're really breathing. It's really learning that sniff, that smelling and inhaling are the same. Okay. So I ask people when they're on the toilet to just lean forward a little bit, put their finger under their nose and smell and feel the bottom open, because that's how urine should leave the body and stool. And you felt it, I could see, because you did it perfectly right. And that's a brain connection that you just made that you will never not have. I changed your life. I changed your life by telling you that your sniff hits your bottom and opens. And that's what you needed to know. And it will help you as you get older understand how urine should leave. And that's all we have to do for each other. We have to spread the word. We need to make this something that we teach each other and our children so that we can lose this terrible crisis of pelvic floor dysfunction that's on our planet.
Yes, that's a wonderful mission you are on. And I just want to make it even broader. I feel like this type of breathing not only good for our pelvic floor health, it's also helpful for our overall mental health and
Oh my God. Oh my
right,
God. You
sleep
are
health.
so right. So I tell everybody this, and this is something that I really want people to understand. When you sniff to your bottom and you feel your pelvic floor move, you are oxygenating your brain right between your eyebrows. You can feel it pull through. But people need to understand you have to start with your nose. A lot of people start the sniff with their chest. So you really need to go in and watch your movement. So putting your finger under your nose and feeling your belly go out, these are all things you could do to just activate that system, because it has to be perfect. You can't cheat. You have to have a perfect activation of a perfect system for it to save your life.
Just watch out the chest movements, the belly movements, and just pay attention to the
No
whole
chest
body.
movements. I even tell women sometimes you can sort of pull your chest in a little bit and sniff. You want to bypass your chest at all costs, because I massage your heart with your chest as you breathe. You don't want your chest moving at all so that you get full parasympathetic activation.
Yes, we always teach our clients when your chest move, when you breathe, that's a type of anxious breathing. And it's,
Sympathetic activation. It's
not
all true. And
helpful.
this is endocrine, this is neurological. I mean, there's plenty. Everything I'm saying, by the way, I don't like to talk about a lot of studies, but I'm very evidence-based in everything I say. I would not get out here in public and not talk to you about things that I could cite 1,000 articles on. But we're not putting it together in a narrative that people can understand, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Which is very important. Everything comes from evidence-based literatures. And then,
Everything.
always there's a way how to make the public understand how to take this knowledge home, how to use it, how to apply that into their
That's my
daily
job.
life.
That's how I see my job. It's like I'm not out here running the studies, but I really read them. And I have a great scientific mind. And I have a lot of patience. So when I put it together, this is a framework that we can all learn. And you did it today. I'm so proud of you. I just looked at your face. But I want you to know, a lot of people can't learn like what you did. Like, this tells me that you're not overly anxious. You have no neurological problems. You have a good interoceptive skill. You're starting at a high level already. But our patients, they need help to get where you got in 2 minutes. Okay? It's not easy for them. They don't get it. And it requires a lot of us to intervene with our fellow sisters and teach them how to do this.
Wonderful. Love all the information you shared. Any last wisdom you want send out before the end?
Well, you should know there's help if you have problems with your bottom, and you should always look for doctors who specialize or pelvic floor therapists. There's a lot of good ones. If anybody tells you to Kegel, tell them that you're going to make another appointment with another person. Breath work is really important, and if you want to know about this in a framework, you could read my book. It's called The Second Mouth. It's on Amazon. It's a Kindle, it's a soft book, and it's a story. It's a story about all of us and how I look at people in my office. So it's not a very like hard book to read. It's actually quite funny, and it pokes fun at all of us, including myself. So yeah, there's a lot of me in there and my own dysfunctions and how I had to get over it myself. You know, I had pelvic floor dysfunction too, but I've overcome it, and I think I can help a lot of people through that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I will put your information and the book link down there to the show note and on our website of the podcast. Thank you very
Thank
much.
you. Thank you for what you do. So important. Thank you for all the education you bring to your listeners. It's such important work. Thank you.
Thank you too. I hope you liked my conversation with Dr. Fleshman. Please feel free to check out her book, The Second Mouth. If you have any questions about sleep health and sexual health, please feel free to leave a message down below in the YouTube channel or the podcast platform. I'm Dr. Yi Shen, adjunct faculty at Stanford Medical Center, a board-certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist, and a certified sex therapist. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time. Bye.
Sleep is an individual thing. We all sleep differently, and there is so much we can do to improve sleep quality. Keep hope and carry on. This podcast is for general informational purpose only and does not include the practice of medicine or other health professional services. Usage of the information we share is at the listener's own risk. And our content does not intend to be a substitute for any medical and professional services, diagnoses, and treatment. Please seek professional health services as needed.